You're listening to a Why Now podcast.
This is the Worldwide Will Show on whynow.co.uk. I'm your host, Will. I'm a British Army veteran of just short of 11 years and served numerous tours of Afghanistan. In this show, I'll be speaking to former members of the British Armed Forces and Coalition Forces, giving them a platform of which to tell their life story, as well as experiences and how it's affected them. I hope you enjoy the show. Welcome to Worldwide Will Show. I'm joined by
Hari Bremagar.
Thank you for coming on, Harry. Really appreciate it. Basically, as you guys know, this podcast is designed and pushed out to tell people's life story. I believe everyone's life is a story, and it's down to them to tell it. So, Harry, where did it all start? Back in Nepal? What year were you born?
I was born in 1979.
Oh, that's old as fuck. Go on.
I was born in July 1979.
Yeah.
I think I can remember my date of birth.
So, from our notes, you were born in a cow shed. Is that right? Is that true?
Yes, it's absolutely true.
So you're pretty much Jesus.
not really. At the time, my parents used to move around the cattles. Mm-hmm. A couple of months in a couple of places and a couple of months in another.
Was that
places.
Seasonal?
It was seasonal, yes. Yeah. So in the warmer weather, you bring the cattles to the higher ground. Mm-hmm. And in the cold, you bring the cattles
around
the low ground. So I was born when I was in higher ground.
Wow. Well, what elevation were you at?
It was around 2,500, I guess. Not exactly sure.
So that's still higher than Snowden, probably.
It's higher than Ben Nevis as well.
There you go. Altitude, baby. So back in Nepal, in my notes, it said you used to walk to school barefoot.
Yes. Wow. At the time, we didn't have any like commercial t-shirts. We didn't have any slippers, commercial slippers. Mm-hmm. And you know, my mom used to sew us by hand, which is made. Those clothes are made in the village, and she sew us, and we used to very shy to wear that one. and we had no choice than walking barefoot to school.
Yeah.
We didn't have any pen and paper, so we had to write on a wooden plank with a chalky stone. We didn't have a commercial chalk, so we had to write with a chalky stone. You have to go to find and cut it with the saw and write it with that.
Wales are still like that. Yeah, that's amazing. So, childhood, what was that like for you? Were you a good kid, bit of a mischievous kid?
I think I would both mixed. I think some ways I was pretty good.
Yeah.
At the time, I had two sisters. Mm-hmm. And they never went to school because it was kind of son. They used to prioritize the son. Mm-hmm. And son goes to school. And sister,
learns home life.
Home life, working in the field. Mm-hmm. And my older sister still now sometimes complains with my dad that, you should send us to school so that we could able to write to our husbands. They are gonna sending you a letter, it was an email or anything like that, text message or anything. So so it will be public. It's not like private.
You learned to read and write on a wooden plank.
Yes, wooden
and
plank.
And a cut stone.
Yeah.
That's outrageous. That's amazing.
Man, it is hard. Hard at the time, and we have to carry wooden planks to the school. Mm-hmm. And we used to use for different purposes as well.
Yeah,
so,
of course.
When you fight with your friends, then you can use that wooden plank.
You can use your wooden planks to beat them.
Yeah. Did you always
know you wanted to be in the army when growing up? Did you know much about the army back then? Or?
Not really. No. So when we grew up in Nepal, armies and police is not taken very nicely. Mm-hmm. So Nepalese armies and police, what they do is, you know, when they come to your village, you know, they run away with your sisters.
Yeah.
So it wasn't really good. So, you know, I didn't want it to be that. But my dad's dream was to be joined army. And my dad, so my great granddad was just one. My granddad was just one, and my dad also one, and we were three brothers, and I was the oldest one. And my dad went to, you know, he escaped and went to India to join the army. And my granddad went and brought him back. Because,
really?
Yeah, at the time, if you lose a son,
yeah,
then it's, you know, nobody's going to carry forward your family trees.
The
family name. So he couldn't able to join. So he always used to tell me that, yeah, one of my son, make sure you join the army. He used to tell me that you couldn't. So as a being a Nepalese boy, you can join to the four different armies. So British Army, which is best paid job, then Singapore, and then Indian and Nepalese Army. And he used to tell me that, try Indian. If you can't, Nepalese Army also good. I think he had a couple of friends that, you know, was in the army. And I think they looked really smart, I guess.
Yeah.
And he always wanted to be like them. And even in, and also in Nepal, it's not about like here that you got a freedom and you can go and choose your dreams. You know, in Nepal is like you're fulfilling your parents' dream. so that's one thing is that was that. But also, when I was going through the high school, a couple of my friends joined to the British Army.
What do people think of the British Army over there?
It's the best job.
Oh, yeah?
The best job you can ever have.
That's awesome.
For a Nepalese wow. boy. Yeah, we get paid more than Prime Minister of Nepal. So it's very, very demanding job. And yeah, lots of people want to join the army. So when I joined in 1999, and we had over 10,000 applicants.
Wow.
And 230 were successful. So, you know, it's not just being a best of the best, but also you have to be lucky, you know. Sometimes it's like getting a Euro Million.
Yeah, yeah.
Euro Million. Yeah. So,
and can those of the 10,000 that applied and didn't get in, can they reapply?
Yes, they can. So there is age that you can apply. So you have to have 18 years old, and you shouldn't cross 22 years.
Oh wow! So 22 years. That's it.
You can't. That's it. Yeah. Yeah, I think now that dropped down to, I think, 21. I'm not sure, but I think it's 21.
Wow. So, 2009, sorry, not 2009, 1999, you were successful. Did you get a letter? How did they tell you?
No. Selection process was a three selection process. So, first is a recruiter go to the village and they select you. So maybe a couple of hundred people, and they select you 60. So one recruiter can take only the 60. So maybe we were a couple of hundred, and we get selected to 60. Then 60, so we'd go to the ARO selection, call it, so regional selection. And that goes to 60, so only they can take 6 out of 60.
Wow.
Then you go to the central selection, so 1 month, you get tested pretty much for everything. So your education, so simply math and English and some IQs. Your team socializing skills, teamwork, command task, you know, fitness, medical, you can name
everything.
It. So pretty much every, so it's nearly a month.
Wow.
And every day people just, you know, they just go away, you know, they just dropped out. And the final ones are in the in you know, finally it's just lined up like a you're like in the military, that like in the squad.
Yeah.
And whoever having successful, they called out names and they take and they just go away. And yeah, I was fortunate enough to join. But yeah, there was lots of hurdles as well. At the time, there was a mass uprising going on at the time. So that lasted for 10 years, and more than 17,000 people were killed. And my village was a peak point of those that uprising.
Yeah. Was that against the government? The uprising?
Yes, it was against the government. So it's a Maoist uprising. Mm-hmm. So they're in the government at the moment. So we have a peace now. and yeah, actually, when our recruiter were you know kidnapped by Maoist, so actually I supposed to. So we are in district capital. Mm-hmm. I was studying, going college at the time, and there's two guys. And we supposed to go to the next morning, leave next morning to go to the selection. Mm-hmm. But you know, I went this afternoon, and you know, what time we going? I was just going to check, and they were just left this in the morning. And you know, for me it's a luck. So they confiscated all those get pass. And kidnapped the recruiters and take away for a couple of days, and they released them, and they came to report to the headquarters. Mm-hmm. Then they went back again and recruited. So you know, I could able to go there. Mm-hmm. And yet, if let's say, you know, there wasn't they didn't confiscate the get pass, then I wouldn't even be pushing here. From that recruiter, I was just only one who actually joined. So it's like they kidnapped those recruiters for me.
Yeah. You're the one that got in.
yeah.
That's
so
amazing.
Yeah, so it was, so I kind of remember that, you know, you couldn't able to take any kind of, in there wasn't any middle ground.
Yeah.
So when you talk about freedom and things like that, lots of people here, they take a granted.
Yeah, 100%.
But, you know, you have no choice. You know, you can, you know, you're going to school and you never know you're coming back home or not.
That's it.
You know?
That's crazy.
And I have to go to one day away from home to go to the high school.
That's madness.
Yeah. And we have to have a cook ourselves, you know, carry the food from, you know, walk
away. But that's prepared you for life, you know?
Yes. I think where I am now, I think it's all about the struggle that I went through, and I think that taught me quite lots of things in my life. I think
100%. Yeah, I think, dare I say it, the younger generation are a little bit too soft now, because they've had it a little bit too easy, you know.
Yes, I think so. You know, I think this is what is, I think, is a good thing. So I was speaking to the one of the private school in Canterbury this morning. Mm-hmm. And how privileged they were, I told them about. I think whatever it is, just, you know, take a challenge. If we don't take a challenge, we don't learn. And the challenge gives us, experience and knowledge. And that gives us confidence. And confidence is everything in life. And 100%. If you don't believe yourself, you can't do anything.
For me, you never really fail until you give up. That's the only time you fail. You learn lessons from failing, in quotations, but you only fail, truly fail, when you give up.
Yeah, I think so. To be honest, I failed many times in my life. I was failed in class 8, was it like a year 8 here?
Yeah.
So in Nepal, if you fail, you're going to stay forever in that class.
Oh, wow.
Right? You're never going to. It's not like here, every year you're going to go. So you could see many different ages in same class. I fell in one time in year 8. So I couldn't pass English in SLC. It's equivalent to GCSE in here. Mm-hmm. And I have to re-give a test. And to give a test, you have to wait a year.
Oh, no.
So yeah, I failed many times in my life, but I think just never give up. You know,
I think that
gives you lots of lessons and just move forward in the life.
100%. So those three stages that you pass, and by the end you were just the only one through circumstance as well. Did they tell you there and then that you're in the British Army?
Lined up. So we lined up, and the four guys on my left, they're gone out. You know, they just called name and just, you have to line. You're gonna go and line other side. The guys who selected, and they missed me, and I thought that they're gonna call my name.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's other five guys on my right hand side. You know, they dropped out. They called for, and. I thought that, you know, are they successful? Am I the one who's going home?
Yeah.
And later on, one recruiter came and initially they kind of treat you really nicely. You know, those like a section commander.
Excuse me. Yeah.
Bless you. Section commanders and platoon commanders, they treat you very well.
Mm-hmm.
And once you join,
they
completely change their beard. And my platoon commander came and kicked on my ass. And kicked me on my ass. Oh, shit. I joined it, but I felt very bad.
Yeah.
Because we stayed for 1 month and I already made good friends. And oh man, all my friends are gone.
Mm-hmm.
So what am I going to do on my own? I felt to be honest, I wasn't very happy then.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
So many of my friends went.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's crazy. So was it straight to Catrick ICT?
No.
No.
Once we had passed selection process, then it was about a couple of weeks. I think about 4 weeks that we go through the drills and how to dress up and those things like that. They issues you the kids. So we do like a without arms drill.
Mm-hmm.
So how to march, simply as that. How to eat and how to clean your
equipment and your shoes and your boots and
that's also, but also how to go to the toilet in European style. How to use the fork and knives.
Yeah,
because we always use our hands and yeah. Also how to use the toilet paper as well. This is pretty much they teach us
cultural training.
Yeah, cultural training to military training, pretty much everything. And at the end of about 4 or 5, so I'm not sure exactly. So we take a oath for the Queen.
That's awesome.
Then we flew up here to Heathrow Airport. And
it was freezing.
It was in January, February. I think February 2nd we came.
Yeah.
And we went to Church Gurkham. So we had the last intake to train. In 1999, then from 2000, our recruit depot moved to the Catrick.
Yeah.
So I was the last intake to train in South Gurkham. And we went there. I thought that, like, when it's all hear about London, one of the most developed countries in the world. And we went, and it's like a mate. It's like a SEDS, right? And like there's accommodation, like a second, I think they built in Second World War, And it, we came out the bus, so it's not like a bus in Nepal, so you have an AC in here, in the heater, so you get warm. So once you're coming out, it was raining, so foggy. I think it's a bit of dark. You call it typical English weather,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And you're going to the huts. Man, is it real? United Kingdom.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure. And we didn't go out or allowed to go out until 2 months.
Okay.
So we stayed in the camp. So we used to line up in the morning and you march together with your plates and forks on your hands to the cookhouse for breakfast and lunch and things like that. And we were line, once you once you eat and then, you know, you lined up to come back again. So we are not allowed to go on our own. So you have to march in the squad. And I used to, when it clear the sky, I used to look out in the sky and you see the aeroplanes fly around in blue skies. And, you know, you can see the trails of the aeroplanes. When am I going back home? Oh, man. Yeah. Even lots of boys say, I don't know. I don't want to do the job. I want to go back home. Just you need to get used to it after after a few months and you'll be fine.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's completely cultural shock.
Yeah, sure.
It was completely different all as well. Mm-hmm. So after 2 months, we went to town. So we didn't know where to go. I remember we were from. We wanted to walk from Tsarskrugham, where our camp, to the fleet town. Mm-hmm. We're going down and we were in group and asked one of the orderly couples there walking their dogs and West End, can you source the way to the plate? Said, plate? We don't know what is a plate. So we later they couldn't tell us, you know, what are we saying. So we actually wrote, oh, that's a fleet. we went to fleet. And they saw us right away. We queued in a McDonald's. We never eaten a McDonald's, like burgers and things like that. And you have to queue in Nepal. Who's going first, right?
That's so funny.
And also, we used to say, oh, you got a good English. You go and speak to them. And even buying something. The good thing in the UK is you don't have to bargain. So you go and pick up and go and pay it, right? But still, you know, we used to push each other. Oh, you go first. You got a better English. You can go. And
that's like, brilliant. It's completely different
world. Yeah. It's a completely different planet.
That's crazy.
And there's a little house, but when you go inside, you know, you have good facilities, you've got a heater inside.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. It's completely different.
Yeah. So was that technically your basic training?
Yes. Yeah. So normally, like you do 2 months basic training, right?
Yep.
We do 9 months.
Yeah.
So it's quite long.
So you're good to go when you get to battalion?
Yes, I think lots of things that, because we are from different cultures, mm-hmm. so we mm-hmm. need to learn lots of things culturally mm-hmm. as well, mm-hmm. but also military skills as mm-hmm. well. And mm-hmm. I think we didn't have very good command of English as mm-hmm. well, so we have to learn.
When you got to battalion, did you recognize anyone from home?
Yes.
Yeah?
One guy. He was in my school, so
it was good to see a familiar face.
Yeah, I used to hear lots of guys' name mm-hmm. in the village, but never they don't go back to mm-hmm. villages. Mm-hmm. Once they join, they settle down in the cities.
I was going to ask how often do guys go home?
At that time, we used to go once in 3 years' time.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, that's how it was. Later on, so we didn't have our rights to settle down here. We uh-huh. we done 15 years.
And which is also, shocking. Yeah.
15 years. And also, we're not allowed to come back here. And we used to call family permission. Mm-hmm. So you are only allowed to bring your families for just for 3 years. So about when your service is about 9 years, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. then you can.
That's crazy. You can bring. That's crazy. Have the rules changed now?
Yes, since 2007.
Yeah, so they should.
Rules has changed, and yes, there is still some difference. The soldiers who served before 1997, mm-hmm. but I was luckily served in 1999 mm-hmm. and. Yes, initially up to 2007, I didn't get same pay as you, but
that's crazy.
After 2007, then everything is equal now.
Good. So, because at one point they weren't allowed, once their service had done, they had to go back to Nepal. They weren't. Were they allowed to be? Were they classed as US UK citizens then?
No. Actually, were you not even allowed to have a work permit and come back and work here?
Wow. What?
Yeah, that's still. How it was. At that time.
Oh, that time, okay. Time,
before 2007.
Excuse me.
So, after 2007, mm-hmm. so, you know, they make a new rules that were able to come and settle down here.
So I remember reading in the newspapers, it was a massive sort of, the people, the UK people kicking off about it, the fact that Gurkhas, once their time had served, weren't allowed to stay in the UK.
Yes, yeah, and everything was put under the carpet.
That was shocking.
And it was in public domain. And yeah. when the journal Lumley, mm-hmm. She knew that, you know, mm-hmm. that's not mm-hmm. right. Mm-hmm. And she started campaign, then mm-hmm. it went to the public, and mm-hmm. public, it's amazing that how public support us.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
And if they didn't support us, I think I would be in Nepal, maybe just waiting my death. Death
I mean, you know, you serve the country, you put your life on the line. The least you deserve is to to be a citizen of the country you're defending, you know?
It's all a political thing, so, you know, I can't, you know, of course, answered lots of totally things. But, it was hard life, mm-hmm. Definitely. Mm-hmm. And now it's better, and I'm very glad that, you know, UK government give us a right to settle down here. And I think there are still a few issues, like, so in masses of the elderly veterans came here and mm-hmm. their families, and I told you about cultural things. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So most of them possibly serve in Brunei, and you know where the mm-hmm. British was based, and still we are based there, and based in Singapore, I think Malaya, mm-hmm. and some of, you know, was based in Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. So they never been in the UK. So culturally, I think it's completely different. Yeah. I think maybe government should maybe made some cultural awareness before they come, I think they had got like lots of problem, like in the older sort and some mm-hmm. some other part of the areas.
Yeah.
I think I don't think so. It's their fault, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I think because if you don't know, is you don't know, and you know.
Yeah,
I think when you get old, I think it's very hard to adapt to the new situation as well.
Can't teach an old dog new tricks.
Which is sad, and I think lots of public were mm-hmm. upset as well. But you know what it is,
mm-hmm. definitely. So, you got to battalion. Like you said, you recognise one guy from your village. It's quite nice to see a familiar face or someone from where you're from.
Yeah, it was kind of like you know, you meet your family member.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was like that. And later I heard about quite lots of names, not all from my village, but some other villages. Mm-hmm. You know, and later on the stage, you know, when we start serving and just start recognizing them, and you know, we had some common things, maybe mm-hmm. some of our languages, mm-hmm. and some tribes. Later on, you know, it wasn't like that. I want to give up and go back to my country, or go back to my family.
Is it Dari? You speak Dari in Nepal as well? Dari or Pashto, which one?
That's the Afghanistan language. So we speak.
Is it similar to Dari? Because I remember some of the Gurkhas that we worked out there could speak with locals.
So we speak Hindi, so we're heavily influenced by India mm-hmm. and Bollywood. Mm-hmm. So we pretty much all understand Hindi. And pretty much everyone speaks Hindi. So mm-hmm. in Afghanistan, they don't like to call Hindi. So that's called, they call Urdu.
Urdu. There you go. There we go.
We Nepal is so diverse. We have mm-hmm. so different tribes.
Mm-hmm.
I think 136 different tribes we have got in Nepal, and I think about more than 40. I think different languages.
Is a lot of friction between tribes?
No. To be honest, it is so. Now it's slightly kind of because as I said, honey, like a. You know, when the civil war mm-hmm. went, mm-hmm. I think they some kind of used kind of different tribes to,
yeah, yeah.
To achieve their kind of agenda.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you've got a Buddhist temple next mm-hmm. to Hindu temple,
mm-hmm.
And it, you know, it's no problem at all.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
We have got churches, and so I think we are absolutely. It's absolutely good. So we didn't have anything,
mm-hmm.
anything about tribe, anything about religion, anything like that. So you respect each other.
That's good.
You know, so that's how it is.
So it's got peaceful.
It's Nepal. It's yeah. very, very peaceful.
Yeah.
Peaceful.
Yeah. Cool. So in battalion, were operational tours. Was Afghan your first tour or?
It was my first tour, yes. Uh-huh. It was my first tour. So it was 2010.
Mm-hmm.
I was supposed to go to 2007,
mm-hmm.
but at that time I had a big job in Brunei, so my regiment was based in Brunei and
mm-hmm.
Nobody able to do my job mm-hmm. in Brunei, so I had to stay.
Stay
in Brunei. Then later I went to do my.
When did courses. You leave? When you leave Brunei? Because I was there in 2008.
I wasn't at that time. So I was based in Brunei. We have got two infantry regiments.
Mm-hmm.
So every 3 years we change over.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to 2000 to 2003
mm-hmm.
and came back 2003 to 2006 in UK. Then I went back again. So 2006 to 2009. So
right.
6 years
yeah.
I stayed in Brunei. I just visited last month. In Brunei, I visited 10 years later.
Wow.
It's amazing.
Yeah. It changed. It's changed quite a bit.
A little bit. Not much, but mm-hmm. yeah, it changed a little bit.
Yeah, I've only been there once, and that was 2008, and it was different. It was just different to anywhere else I've been before. I've been Belize, and then South America, then America. Went over to Brunei, and it was different. I was just like, this place is a bit weird for me. I'm not used to it.
It's very very warm,
mm-hmm.
so it is very humid.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So yeah,
And the jungle is completely different
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, yes, and you can adjust very quickly,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
very very quickly.
So 2010, is that right?
Yeah, 2010. Yeah.
Afghan tour. Unfortunately, obviously, you were injured. If you don't mind talking us through that, Nari Saraj. Was that right?
Yeah, it is a PV2 Nari Saraj,
mm-hmm.
district that we went, and I was injured at the village called Pankale.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of like we were very early in the tour, and we were not even fully familiarized,
mm-hmm.
And the guys who went before, they took us out. But at the same time, our job was to take two engineers to
right.
Lake Ida well,
yep.
To just provide drinking water for local people because
mm-hmm.
their well was damaged. So into Lake Ida and repair it.
Mm-hmm.
So our job was to just to go and take those two engineers, give a security and
bring them back safe.
It was about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
We were in single file and. I was a 10th person in the
wow.
in the line. We were about 20 people,
mm-hmm.
We were just crossing those compounds,
mm-hmm.
And poppy fields and irrigation ditches,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just when we were going, it just suddenly went bang. Then first thing I noticed was it was ringing my right ear.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I had a radio on the left, so I think it's protected.
Yeah.
Then dust everywhere. Everybody is saying man down.
Mm-hmm.
And I just noticed that, you know, I just thrown out and landed. I couldn't able to move my right arm.
Mm-hmm.
I looked down to my right leg, which wasn't there. Straight away. I had a left leg, but it was like very badly injured.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a bones and skin.
Mm-hmm.
First thing I thought about was, we've just been there, you know? We've been there for give everything,
mm-hmm.
for your regiment,
mm-hmm.
for the boys,
mm-hmm.
and keep them safe, do the job, and come back after 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I was quite in senior, so I was a multiple twice.
Yeah, yeah.
And We had a very young officer who came from Sandhurst.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the most senior guy within the team in the Gurkhas.
Yeah.
So everybody used to look at me, whatever happens, and this I was like their big brother, or some of them like their father figure. Yeah. And I was really worried. I wasn't worried about myself at the time, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
I just worried about what this guy's gonna do, you know,
mm-hmm.
without me, because everything did look at me. So I had two section commanders, and I don't think they were ready to take over yet, if something happened.
Yeah, yeah. Was it a pressure plate or a command wire? Did you find out?
I think it was very old. I heard that it's old pressure plate. So one of the engineer guys went to exploit that that incident, and later he blew himself up, and we met that.
Really?
Yeah, we met at Hedlicott and at the rehabilitation center. it was a very old pressure plate.
Mm-hmm.
I think I stepped in, or someone stepped in, and I was just blown up. I was the same route, mm-hmm. single file, 9% crossed,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm. I got the one who got it.
Just crazy, isn't it?
It's madness.
So you don't know what happens to you.
Yeah, yeah, you know? Yeah.
And just, I was thinking about the boys, you know. Mm-hmm. Even I was still worrying when I come back here, mm-hmm. and it's already 2 months. And MLO, the military liaison mm-hmm. officer, used to say, worried about yourself, don't worry mm-hmm. about you. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. He used to say me. Then later, after that, I am I going to survive,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And also, remember my families.
Mm-hmm. Were you conscious? Did you pass
out?
I
was completely conscious, yes. Wow. I was completely conscious until I go to the helicopter.
Yeah, yeah.
The guys were patching me up, mm-hmm. and they cleared around me and just patched me up.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, who saves you in battlefield? Your family is not going to save mm-hmm. you. They are not there.
Mm-hmm.
Only people who will save you is your colleagues.
The boys.
Your friends,
mm-hmm.
you know, your comrades. And to be honest, one point I thought that it's not real. I felt like, when you go to the training,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
DS said, oh, okay, you are injured. And it says something like that. And you know exactly what's going to happen,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So I knew exactly what's going to happen, who's going to come, what is mm-hmm. who's up is what. And pretty much, training is so much valuable that mm-hmm. It mm-hmm. works everything. But I thought, once I start having a pain, then it's real. And when they're patching me up, they said, heli inbound in 10 minutes. Then I thought, I'm going to survive now then. Then Americans came mm-hmm. and patched me up, and I was still shouting my platoon commander in that team as well. So I was shouting my platoon commander. In Gurkha, in Nepali, we say, Sab, Sab is sir. And Sab, Sab, look after the boys. And it's really, really just shouting him out. And
mm-hmm.
I was really worried about it. And then
straight to Bastion, was it? And then straight to Berlin?
Yes, so I was straight to Bastion. I could remember or two. I did get into heli,
mm-hmm.
Once I was given the mask, then
that was it.
I passed away.
Yeah, yeah.
And next morning, I woke up in Kambasan, my right arm was completely plastered and hung on the side. Mm-hmm. I had a couple of needles on my left arm, mm-hmm. My body was covered. Below my chest was covered by white blanket, and I could remember that I didn't have my right leg, and mm-hmm. I had my left leg,
mm-hmm.
but I just straight my down towards my legs, and it looks like there isn't. I just didn't have that courage to mm-hmm. open mm-hmm. Open the blanket and have a look at. Yeah, I just didn't have a courage.
Yeah.
Later, surgeon came and said, "Yeah, I just amputated you because." It would be risk for your life.
Mm-hmm.
And when I woke up, my commanding officer and Gorkha Major, highest rank in the regiment. For the Gurkhas, and you know they're, you know, just standing next to my bed, and I just felt ashamed lying in the bed in front of them. I think the first thing I told them was, "I'm sorry," because I was there to give my best for my regiment, help them out, you know, and keep everyone safe and come back. And I thought that I felt missing. I couldn't able to help.
Yeah.
So I said, so sorry. Just my tears just dropped down my eyes. That was
an emotional
part. Yeah, time. Really, really emotional. But I was very ashamed as well, you know.
You shouldn't have been. Yeah.
Yeah. And they said to me, "Yeah, don't worry. You fly back and look after the cell. We will take care of here." But that wasn't enough. And I didn't stop worrying for my boys for 2 months. I was very unlucky as well at the time that there was volcanic ash in the Iceland, you know, and no planes could be able to fly to the
Europe. Yeah, yeah.
Then they planned to send me with the Americans to Washington, D.C. Yeah. Man, I just didn't want to go on my own. And I asked, can I have at least a nurse, British nurse, who can go with me? And because I thought that I heard about very horrible stories of the hospitals and so many things. And I think they're just going to kill me.
Yeah.
and to be honest, how many guys were there? You know, those doctors and nurses didn't have any time to even rest, I think.
Wow.
You know, every minute the casualties were coming.
Yeah.
And they didn't send it to me. But when I looked back, Americans look have taught me very, very well.
That's good.
I think, really. And I went to Bagram, stayed there 2 nights. I had 2 operations with the Americans. The worst thing was I was the only conscious in critical room. In one critical room, there were 4 patients, and none of them were conscious. And we used to be looked after the 1 nurse each. And the nurses and doctors used to rush around and, you know, to the person. And, you know that the computers would be like, beep, beep, beep. Oh, God. And I had, you know, I had so much pain. None of the, you know, they gave me morphine so much. Still didn't work.
My
pain. I thought that I'm going to die there. it was terrible. Then after 2 days, we flew to Iraq in Balad. Next morning, I was supposed to fly to Washington, D.C., but they said, planes could fly to Birmingham. So 1C-17 went and, brought me to the Birmingham.
Yeah, yeah.
So
that was the beginning of the recovery, I suppose, Birmingham.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And
properly, I suppose.
Yeah. So they put me in the ambulance and straight to the... I had to have another operation again.
All right.
I stayed to the theater, and before the theater, they said, "You're going to see your family." I don't know what to expect. And in Nepali, when your children are going away and you bless them, that, please come back as you are going now. You know, that really hurt me. I couldn't come back for my family for my wife, you know. For my children and for my other families, and that really, really hurt hurt me. And outside the theater, I was taken there, and my family came. My wife came at last. So I had a 2.5-year-old son.
Yep.
He came and sat on my lap. He didn't know much, I think, about it. And I was really happy. And I was very pleased to see my son.
Yeah.
But my wife, you know, just came through the door. And she stepped, I think, 1 step, and she couldn't move forward. And I think I was in a terrible mess, I think.
Yeah, as anyone would.
And a couple of weeks ago, I was with, you know, able buddy, you know, the fit man, went to Afghanistan and came back and it's half a body. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, in terrible mess condition. I think that's she saw me.
It was a shock to
her. And I think she was shocked. She couldn't move forward. I thought that she was going to come and maybe tap on my shoulder, even she doesn't give me a hug or kiss, or maybe just rub my hands. That's what I thought. But she just couldn't able to move forward. She started crying and has cried there and helpless and there. Then recovery began. Yeah, it was a very hard time at the time. Yeah.
Well, and then the recovery time. So you left sort of the Queen Elizabeth in Birmingham, Kiwi, is that right?
No. Selyuk. I was in Selyuk.
Selyuk. And then down south, did you go down south to the recovery centre?
Yes. So luckily, I was a very fit guy at the time, you know. And I was, I think, one of the... I lost both legs above the knee, and my right arm was injured. You know, my right ear eardrum was perforated, and some other small injuries, but not really inner complicated injury. So I think I recovered very quickly. So I only stayed in the hospital, I think 21 or 22 days.
Wow.
Only I stayed in Selyuk. Then after that, I went to Headley Court, and pretty much everything started. And even in Birmingham, in Selyuk, we had a military wing, so all the military casualties were there. It was really, really kind of terrible ward. You know, some guys missing, you know, three limbs, two limbs, and, you know, it just kind of, some people couldn't be able to... speak. Just, you could imagine,
horrific injury.
You could see the family's face. Man, it was really terrible scene. And I think I don't want to see that scene again.
No. Yeah, I went to visit a few of our guys, obviously who were sort of IEDs or gunshot wounds, or one of our guys hit a legacy mine, blew him out of the Wimmick and broke his back, and they said he'll never walk again. Thankfully, he did another tour. He rehabilitated and did another tour just because he's stubborn. But that ward, I know exactly what you're talking about. It's a hard place to be, especially when you see the new guys coming straight into the ward, straight out of theatre, who've just come back from Afghanistan, and then the families as well come in to see. It's a horrible place to be. And I totally agree. I never want to go there again, and touch wood, I never visit any of my friends there again. So down at Headley Court, how long did you spend down there in total?
3.5 years. It's a long time.
Was that coming back, going home, coming back for more?
Yes, it was. So we're not allowed to. So what I wanted, to be honest, initially, I wanted to be at Headley Court and all the time be there and just get recovered.
Get done and go.
Yeah, and go. But we're not allowed to do that. So you're going there 4 weeks and you're going home 4 weeks. So, at Headley Court 4 weeks, they teach you so many things and, you know, just start, you know, swimming again. I went swimming and, you know, your legs came straight up, your head is down.
Yeah.
It's so hard to balance.
Yeah.
It took quite a while to balance. And to be honest, now I swim faster than I used to
swim
with my legs.
Really?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And, you know, start fitting the legs. We started from little legs called stubbies. Physio, and also some other bits as well, mainly fitness. Some other things, how to integrate to the society.
Yeah, yeah.
I was really, really afraid to go out, just with my carer, with my family. One thing is, initially, I was kind of didn't accept myself. And secondly, even the society, community, I thought that, you know what this guy is doing. So why is not? So many ways I didn't let go out. Yeah. Even I went out, people used to comment about my injuries. And
I know exactly what you're talking about. A very good friend of mine had almost a carbon copy injuries as you did from an IED. And people were just staring. And it wound me up more than it did Simo.
Mm.
And I'd be like, what the fuck are they staring at? And he's like, it's all right. I'm used to it now. Obviously, it took him a while to get used to people looking. Because in their defense, you don't see every day someone with two prosthetic legs.
Even at the time, we did not. It took about a year to get back to the prosthetic legs.
Mm-hmm.
And initially, I was in a wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
So in you can imagine that how my community is very conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they look at the disability. And I used to go to them. It's like some community parties. And people used to come in, you know, why this guy is coming here, you know, why he doesn't stay at home.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if I let's say something like, I want to enjoy it. And he said, oh, even the guy with no legs want to enjoy. You know, I'm still the same.
Yeah.
Man. Only thing is I don't have legs, right? I'm still the same Hari Buddha. My brain is the same. My heart is the same.
Yeah.
Only thing is, you see, I don't have legs.
Mm-hmm.
So what is wrong with that?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
So I couldn't accept myself initially. And the best thing, I think, after my injury was I could able to recognize myself who I am.
Yeah.
And I think lots of people try to be other person,
mm-hmm.
you know, some successful people, and they forget their identity.
Yeah.
And I think it's very important that we recognize ourselves.
Yeah, know
we
make, who we are.
We know who we are. We make our own brand.
Yeah, yeah.
We make ourselves, and that's only when that gives you happiness.
Yeah,
it gives you confidence.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't accept yourself, then I think
how can you expect anyone else to accept you?
Yeah. So when they say, oh, this is a poor guy, and something like that, and no, I don't want to be their poor guy.
Yeah.
You know. You know, I think now they stop saying it.
But
I think when I went home, so helicopter was fine. So, you know, it's like every little step, you know, mm-hmm. progressing or recovering. Mm-hmm. But when you go back home, what you do,
mm-hmm.
right? Is you have a wife and children. But what you gonna do, man?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so 4 weeks. So mostly it was about, you know, I did lots of things that, so whatever things that I'm doing, I've done lots of about research on the properties and mm-hmm. things like that. Mm-hmm. That is the time I did. That's a good thing, but how much, you just can't do all the time the same thing, you know, there. So lots of times it was about drinking. And in the evening especially, one glass and another mm-hmm. glass. And one point, I was so drunk. I could drink a bottle of Jack Daniels just myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I was still okay, you know. Mm-hmm. I used to drink 7 days a week. And when I didn't drink, you know, I feel very unwell.
Mm-hmm.
And my brains get foggy.
Mm-hmm.
And my hands
irritated.
My hands like shaky. Kind of drink. So you can't concentrate and so many things and get angry. If I'm going to go this way, I think I'm going to die very soon. Lots of time I thought about killing myself
in
that time. And I didn't have legs, so I was in a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. I couldn't able to drive at that time. You know, when you look at the ceilings, you know, you could see where could possibly you hang yourself up.
Yeah.
I used to see the bridges and, you know, how could able to jump.
Fucking hell.
But
thankfully you didn't. It's a very, very hard time to go through. See, I did exactly what you did. I tried to compensate with drink as well. And I'd be drinking most nights. And I was in a very, very dark place myself. You know, you do have really bad thoughts like that. And the only thing that literally pulled me through was getting a dog. Getting my dog literally took me from thinking of killing myself to wanting to make my life better within 3 months. Is the timeline from getting my dog to me thinking, I need to sort this out. I need help. And that was it. That was me. That was my time scale. And the way it was turned around, for me, is incredible. I think we need to do more about service dogs and stuff. But
yeah, absolutely.
So when did you come out of that sort of dark patch?
So for me, it was like, especially my family.
Mm-hmm.
I can kill myself. And, you know, that's end of story.
Mm-hmm.
But because of that, what impact will make it in other people's life?
Yeah, yeah.
Especially my family. And that will definitely going to affect on my families.
Mm-hmm.
So even I don't have legs, still I could advise them mm-hmm. to my children a couple of things.
Still be a good father.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I didn't know I could be a good father, but I think I could do a couple of things. I didn't know what I was going to do.
Uh-huh.
But again, I think that now I want to live for my family, uh-huh. you know?
Uh-huh.
And I want to get valued
uh-huh.
as the same as before. So it was like initially, how am I going to bring a food on the table?
Uh-huh.
You know, it's very hard. And whether I was going to stay in the military for how long.
Yeah, sure.
Don't know as well. I thought about my family and no, I'm not going to die. I want to do something.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know what to do.
Uh-huh.
But I'm going to do something.
100%.
So that's how I pretty much turned around. And uh-huh. the first thing I did was skydiving.
That's awesome.
So I wasn't in the parachute regiment. Mm-hmm. I never done skydiving before. So one thing is I want to take experience of that.
Mm-hmm.
And second thing is I was a bit suicidal mode. So if I I die, then that's end of my story again.
Yeah.
So so we went to Nether Haven.
With a battle bag.
Mm-hmm. Went to the 15,000 feet, in the sky. Mm-hmm. And I looked there down and the cloud is on there. You couldn't see anything there. You want to die. You're still scared.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A bit scared, but you know, I'm Gurkha, you know.
That's it.
Our motto is it's better to die than be a coward.
There you go.
So I can't be a coward. Yeah. So I have to fall down.
So I'm going out of that plane.
So we just kind of shuffle it down, and I just close my eyes, jump down. And I felt really great. One thing is kind of, I feel first time I'm a bit free.
Yeah.
Free from my wheelchair.
Yeah.
Then I thought that when I was landing, I might land it like an egg, you know. But I didn't, when we landed safely, then I thought that,
mm-hmm.
actually, even if you don't have both legs, you mm-hmm. can be able to do something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that gave me really little confidence.
Brilliant.
And when we talk about the confidence. Confidence is not like you got a magic stick and mm-hmm. say, abracadabra, kiching, here you go. Mm-hmm. You got a magic and rule the world. It's not like that. It's like that. And from my experience, it's every little things is super important in a life
mm-hmm.
to what you will be in the future.
Mm-hmm. Even little achievements.
Yes, it's really little things. So after my injury, my aim was to how to get onto the wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't able to jump in the wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't jump from a wheelchair to transfer from myself from wheelchair to car.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I couldn't able to brush my teeth myself. I couldn't go to the toilet myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So every little things that helps. So that was a kind of my next goal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So one by one. So it's a brushing your teeth, put a cloth yourself, dress up yourself, take mm-hmm. your medication yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, later on about, you know, transfer on the car,
mm-hmm.
start driving yourself, them, other things. And one little step in a life makes so much difference. So
yeah.
we don't have to worry about anything. Just be a present and do your best.
Yeah, yeah.
Try to do, achieve whatever goal you have. But I think if we could be able to do it, then, we could do so much in the life.
Oh, and amazing. Yeah, 100%. And then you went from sort of the skydiving into other sports like climbing. I know that's a big thing for you now, climbing and mountaineering.
Yeah, after my injury was about... So after that, so after losing my both legs, what can I do physically?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that was my question for myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I was start trying to do sports and mm-hmm. adventures. So... Battleback has been great for me.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much other things like a golf,
yeah.
like on course foundation, you know, like say Style for Soldiers, who gave me lots of confidence
yeah, yeah.
and my how I look, and lots of kayaking with them.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's so many things like a Blazma who helped me so many things like.
Yeah.
Sorting out my compensation to adapting my house to so many things.
Yeah.
After that injury, that's main thing was what can I do physically?
Sure.
You know.
Sure.
I didn't know about how powerful is the mental and mindset.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
So I just start trying doing the things. So I did start doing from small things like staying in a wheelchair, doing things like wheelchair basketball,
yeah,
wheelchair
yeah.
rugby.
Yeah, yeah.
I start loving once you bashing others.
Yeah, yeah.
And even I tried football, which is very hard. and I just like swimming,
mm-hmm.
Climbing, kayaking, skiing. Javelin, tracks,
wow.
Wheelchair races, you pretty much anything that I have got, I could find mm-hmm. find to do that.
Brilliant.
I had the opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
So I kind of start testing myself and mm-hmm. I have done one. Yeah, that's ticked. I want to do another one.
Mm-hmm.
That's ticked. Another one. Mm-hmm. Tick. So after that, I think I did all the Paralympic that mm-hmm. sports that exist. I tried it.
Mm-hmm.
At least. And lots of adventures as well. Then I actually found that nothing is impossible.
Mm-hmm.
It's just different way of doing the things.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just adapting the life. You know, I'm here with my prosthetic legs here. If I didn't have prosthetic, I'd come with my wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about, like I said, it's a simple principles that applies to our life. We everybody are adapting our life in so many ways, but we don't realize that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, say, for me, it's like coming out from Nepal to coming to the UK, culturally adapting
yeah,
my
yeah,
life.
100%.
You know, if we go out, what are we going to do? If it's cold, we're going to put a jacket on, right? If it's going to rain, then we're going to put a raincoat or
an
umbrella, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So if you can't walk, you're going to use a wheelchair. So if you can't use a manual wheelchair, what's you going to use?
Mm-hmm.
Electric wheelchair, right? Also, if it's too warm, you are in a t-shirt or something like that. If you go to the party, you got a party dress.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a life. I realize that. You know, life is all about adaptation. So we adapt our life according to the time
mm-hmm.
and situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so we go to the soldier's mode, right?
Of course. Improvise, adapt, and overcome.
So just giving one example, we couldn't able to, run fast enough. to explore the world. Mm-hmm. So we start designing the things. So we design the roads, cars,
planes,
and cars and boats and ships for the sea, mm-hmm. and planes to make it more quicker.
Yeah.
Now we can fly to the another planet. Who made that possible? Is a human, us, and we're so intelligent. As long as we can challenge ourselves, mm-hmm. and you know, be disciplined, mm-hmm. and move forward, we can achieve so much things.
100%. A friend of mine has got a clothing brand called Redcoat Apparel, and his slogan for his business is always moving forward. And he gives a lot to sort of charities, PTSD and all that good stuff. But I always think that in itself, always moving forward, I think that always needs to be pushed to the forefront of everything. Because like you said, if you had stayed in the same position you are, you probably wouldn't be here today. And that mindset changed, that you need to move forward, you need to adapt. And you did. And now Mount Everest is on the cards.
That's right. Yes, it's everything is about mindset. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll just give you one example. So let's say our Prime Minister is a Boris Johnson now. How much he use his physical body to run the country? I think he can sit on a wheelchair and run the country.
Of course he can.
So I think there's anything is possible.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's just a different way of doing it, adapting our life. And one day, I want to promote a universal accessible system, mm-hmm. so that everybody can reach wherever they go.
That's brilliant.
You know, it's just like say coming to the third floor, going to the third floor in the balcony, mm-hmm. bird doesn't need adaptation to fly up there. We need adaptation, so mm-hmm. we design the stairs. So now, whole building is designed for able bodies.
Yeah.
Who have legs. So now, we need. This is the reason why. So at the moment, it's especially developing countries. Mm-hmm. It's lots. Lots of things are adaptable, mm-hmm. but still there are many not. But like, so when you look at Nepal, I haven't even seen one public disabled toilet yet.
Wow.
So this is all about mm-hmm. my climb, and mm-hmm. I think we'll talk about it later. Mm-hmm. But I think that's what it's all about.
100%.
And I think I survived to make a difference. And I don't want to waste my time. I know now that how is the value of life, mm-hmm. and make sure we use as much as we can
to help others as well.
Yeah, and make our life meaningful, mm-hmm. but also making other people's difference in other people's life.
100%. So, Mount Everest, is it on the cards? Is it off the cards with the coronavirus and all that good stuff?
It's on the card still, mm-hmm. But I think it's lots of uncertainty about at the moment.
Yeah.
We might lock down. I think lots of airlines says they already cancelled their mm-hmm. flights in mm-hmm. a couple of cities. Mm-hmm. A couple of countries are already locked down.
yeah.
But also the funding. Mm-hmm. So funding is, I found, actually funding is harder than actually climbing Mount Everest.
Yeah. That's a mountain in itself.
that's a mountain itself. So there are lots of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. So we're not sure that we're still doing this year.
You're saying earlier on that if it is cancelled, then it'll be next year.
Yeah, it's definitely gonna be next year. Then few more mountains, few more records. And next year, I think giving up is not in my diary. Mm-hmm, so, mm-hmm.
So in preparation, what sort of training have you been doing, ready for Everest?
So I have done quite a few trainings.
Yep.
I climbed about 7 different trainings I have done. I've done few passes, like a Thorongla pass, Jangla pass in Nepal, which is over 5,000 meters. But mainly I climbed Mont Blanc, Mont Blanc in France. I climbed, just in last January, I climbed Kilimanjaro, Mount Kilimanjaro, which is the highest mountain in Africa. I climbed Chulu Far East, which is 6,058 meters, and I climbed Merapik, which is 6,476 meters.
And but you haven't done Snowdonia.
I'll definitely go one day. That's not a problem for me. I can go on a weekend.
Do that in the morning.
Go on a weekend and do that. And I hold world record for climbing, being a first ever double above knee amputee to climb over 6,000 meters.
Wow.
And no one hasn't done, has done it, but I think...
Do you require oxygen at that level, or...?
No, up to 7,000 meters, you don't need oxygen. So, lots of training. It's hard.
Altitude training.
Lots of training. Initially, nobody believed me. when I say I'm going to climb, I didn't say that I was going to climb Mount Everest initially, because I was in testing myself. You know, I started from indoor training went to the outdoor and testing myself, and nobody believed me. So I spent lots of my compensation money to just prove and just put a little bit of credibility on my climbing. And once I have a world record for climbing,
that's awesome.
Merapik, then some people start believing me. I think still lots of people don't believe it, but I think there will be the people who will make a difference. Maybe 0.01% people who will make a difference in the world, and I believe it. If I don't believe it, I wouldn't waste my time.
Of course.
I wouldn't waste other people's time. I wouldn't waste my life. I'm fully committed for that. And if not this year, then definitely I want to climb next year.
That's amazing. So when you do a sort of a summit like that, how big's the team you take with you?
It depends on how high we were going,
okay.
But how technical we are going as well. So for Everest, we are 18, 18 people team. So from Kitchen staff to porters to high altitude porters, low altitude porters to my climbing leaders, expedition leaders to the team doctors, team physios to. Prosthetist to it's about 18 of us so far, I'm three times slower than other people, and takes three times longer. That means need at least three times more money as well it's a big commitment, but I think it's nothing is impossible. We have made so much things possible, so
yeah,
I 100%. Think this is possible. And I think I have proved myself that that I could be able to climb.
That's amazing.
So four major mountains. Lots of people, even with legs, didn't climb those mountains. They couldn't be able to successful. There's there, but mainly is why I want to climb. That's most important thing.
Right.
I think that's really, really important. You know, I could able to, make a money and, adding up my more portfolio.
Yeah, properties.
Properties and do other businesses and some other ways I could make more money. But I think I couldn't buy these things with the money. So make sure I make... I make a difference. So mainly it's about disability awareness. Very, very first point, because my life was changed in a blink of eye. And anybody's life could change. I think last year only in the UK, 927 people lost their life only from road traffic accident.
Yeah.
You could imagine how many were injured.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
So people's just lives changed in blink of eyes. Some are maybe unfortunate to, you know, born in that situation. Mm-hmm. And
excuse me.
When you look at the disability population, so we are now 7.6 billion people in the world, and about 1 billion, around 1 billion disabled people. Some ways disabled people exist in there, and we can't ignore those big people. No. One thing is we could inspire the disabled people to take up challenges, following their dreams, and, you know, achieve as a maximum their potential.
Yeah, yeah.
But also on others as well. Other people has to have to have awareness as well.
So educate.
Educate. And make sure we make aware of the other people as well. So if something happens in their life, they aren't sitting around mourning and complaining.
Mm-hmm.
So they move forward
mm-hmm.
and enjoy whatever they have got and rest of their life and do many things that they want, following their dreams, achieving their dreams. So they could able to do those things. So that's another thing. But I was banned from climbing Everest in 2018. Mm-hmm.
And that was by the Nepalese government?
Yeah, Nepalese government. The reason why it was banned, because they thought that disabled people couldn't do anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I thought, this is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't just ban certain group of people.
Yeah, yeah.
Even they can't do the things.
Mm-hmm.
For me, you can't do things like that. I just don't believe it.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And so the reason why Nepal government banned mm-hmm. is because I think the awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Because even they are very highly academically educated,
mm-hmm.
they are not educated about the disability.
Sure.
I think that's the reason why, I think one of the reason why they, I think, banned us. It took about 4 months to overturn that rules. And my friends in Nepal who were with the disabilities, we went together. So they went to file the case
mm-hmm.
in the Supreme Court.
That's amazing.
And I campaigned all over the world, and collectively we overturned the rules. We tried initially diplomatic way.
Mm-hmm.
I met lots of politicians, ministers, ambassadors. And British and American ambassador helped me lots on this, but the problem with that is, it's gonna take a long time.
Yep.
And if you got one bureaucrat put the files underneath the table, it's gonna take a long time to go find, bring that file up, and it has to go to many offices, many ministries before it go to the parliament and pass it. And it was, I think, it was a very long process, and I think it wouldn't be happen. So I also went to Geneva
mm-hmm.
in the United Nations to raise this point, but problem with the United Nations is they can't force the country to apply the rules.
Sure.
So, they have signed with CRPD as Convention of Rights of People with Disability.
Right.
But they can't force them. Yeah. So the only way.
Surely it holds weight, though, the fact that they say we agree with you?
Yes. Yeah. So they completely agree with, mm-hmm. with it, and they actually wrote
mm-hmm.
The notes to Nepal,
mm-hmm.
but they can name and shame it, but sure. they can't force the countries to
sure.
apply the rules. So we had to go to Supreme Court in Nepal
mm-hmm.
And overturn the rules.
It's amazing.
I didn't sleep until about 3 months.
Yeah.
But I think this is not just my right.
Sure.
It's the people of disability, right of the people with a disability. And anyone from the world who want to go and climb in Nepal on those mountains, then they couldn't able to do that.
Yeah. So, but now they can.
Now they can. And actually, Jia Bao, the one double amputee below the knee,
mm-hmm.
he actually climbed after we overturned the rules, and he wouldn't able to do that.
Amazing.
You know?
Amazing.
So, you feel good when you, when you open the doors for others.
Definitely. Definitely. Well, I'll take my hat off to you. That's an achievement in itself, is to overthrow a rule like that, that's in legislation that's come down from the government, to allow other people to get that joy from something that you love as well.
Yeah, but also I think, it made lots of awareness about disability, that one.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely didn't want to ban,
mm-hmm.
but I think banning me some way, they did it right. Mm-hmm. So that because I think it went all over the world. And one day I gave an interview to 17 international medias, and you bring into the highlight,
mm-hmm.
and you know that how is Nepal, even the law system could be, overshadowed.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was lots of publicity, mm-hmm. lots mm-hmm. of awareness around, lots of pressure from the other countries, mm-hmm. and press. Five judges unanimously decided that that was wrong.
Brilliant. A win. A victory.
It's a big victory. but this is I call it a bureaucratic Mount Everest that we climbed.
Yeah.
Now we need to climb the real Everest.
Yeah. You're at base camp. You got Everest to climb, yeah. I like it.
Mm,
So life now. You said Everest is on the cards. It's not on the cards. If it's not, it's going to be next year. You're gonna fill that time if it is pushed back to next year. You're gonna fill it with other expeditions, other mountains, summits, and
yes, I just can't sit
sure.
And wait for next year.
Mm-hmm.
My body has to acclimatize time to time. Make sure it needs to stay in that high altitude grid.
Yep.
I think we'll do about two mountains because this is still on the table. So if in case something happens, then two mountains, maybe two more records.
Yeah.
Then
maybe Snowdon as well. we'll do it together. How about that?
Yeah,
we'll
can
do it together.
Yeah, just book for one weekend.
That's it.
Go and
that's
enjoy it. We are actually thinking about that. So possibly in summer we'll do Ben Nevis and our Snowdonia.
That's cool. We'll get in touch and we'll do it together. We'll get some photos and videos on it. Try and get Simo as well.
Yeah,
if I think he's not too busy.
Yeah. If he's happy to come to climb the hills.
Yeah, brilliant. So moving forward, I know you mentioned about you want to make a global awareness of disability and access to all around the world internationally. Is that something you've started, or is it just a vision right now?
At the moment, it's kind of vision.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing it work behind that,
mm-hmm.
and I'm pushing that forward at the moment. But I think that is that's because I'll talk about why bird doesn't need to fly in, mm-hmm. To the third floor, and why we need the stairs to go up,
mm-hmm.
because we adapted. So it did. I think after Everest, even after Everest,
mm-hmm.
I think I'll do possibly two other expeditions, one North Pole and one South Pole.
Wow.
So that making more awareness,
mm-hmm.
but also promoting this a universal accessible system, so everybody can. It's accessible for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the things that I want to promote, and I want to promote with the United Nations and some other things around.
Definitely.
So let's see. Let's look at the Everest, but also at the same time, I will be promoting still these things.
Yeah, definitely. Prince Harry, if you're listening, get on board. Come on, screw the nut.
Until he knows about this.
Yeah, yeah.
He doesn't know about accessibility system.
Mm-hmm.
Universal accessible about that, but he knows that I'm climbing.
He will now.
He knows that I'm climbing. He actually joked for a couple of times as well about this.
Yeah.
So, but I think for me, just climbing Everest is mm-hmm. not just kind of, you know, just for myself, achieving that things. It's about, you know, it's about making a difference. So when I was climbing a mountain, even there was no crampons made for double apoptotic amputees, because no double apoptotic amputee was climbing. So we designed some of the crampons based on one of my friend in Colorado who sent me some of his crampons, and now you can other people are start climbing as Brilliant. Well, and no double amputee above knee, you know, has attempted
yeah.
the Everest yet, and I will be the first person even to attempt that.
And you'll do it?
Definitely. I'm sure, and I think I have done lots, but also it's kind of my childhood dream as well. Mm-hmm. So, so I grew up in the Himalayas, looking at the mountains.
Sure.
And I always wanted to climb the mountain. We used to hear the story of Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay, who climbed the first time on Everest. But also, as a Nepalese children, we get educated that, you know, highest peak in the world is Mount Everest, and it's in Nepal, and we are very proud of that.
Yeah.
And I always fascinated and wanted to climb from child, but just, you know, I couldn't have that privilege to climb.
Yeah.
You know, I was in military. I was more focused on training, operation, and my career.
Yeah, sure.
Army wouldn't leave me for that long to go and climb it. I thought about that, but it wasn't possible. And I lost my legs. Mm-hmm.
But you're here now.
But I have already climbed a few mountains, so that's another mountain to climb. Yes, it's a challenge, but it's one step at a time.
Well, I'll be keeping an eye out. I'll be watching. Keep me updated as well.
Yeah, I will do that.
And we'll get your story published on it as well.
Great.
It's brilliant. Thank you so much, Harry. Really appreciate you coming in.
No problem.
Thank you, Gary.